Now, our chairman tonight is an AA trustee, and he came to the General Service Board from the West Coast region. Specifically, his home is in or just outside of Sacramento, California. His name is Jim M., and if there were citations being given in AA for effort, I think Jim would have earned one of every kind. He's been eager and enterprising and productive in every activity known to groups, to central services, and to general services. Tonight is a high point in Jim's life. This is an AA birthday, and he's sharing it with us, and we in turn are sharing with him his pleasure in this moment. Jim M.
I always wanted to make this many people wait for me. I'm blaming it onto her, but I want one too. I think that Herb mentioned that my name was Jim M. If he didn't, it is. I'm from Carmichael, California. This is of no earthly importance to anybody except my wife sitting down in the front row, but I have to bring it out nevertheless. Seriously, I want to take this opportunity to express my deep gratitude for the privilege of acting as your chairman this evening. I'm not naive enough to think that I was picked on talent. I think Herb mentioned that this was my AA birthday. And back home in Sacramento, of course, or Carmichael, they always give a big party for somebody on their birthday, and I think it's real thoughtful of Toronto to give this big one for me. Thank you. All I can do in saying thanks. Because it gives me the opportunity to smile, and I just got these new plates about a week ago, and I'm real happy. I think that the program and Herb mentioned who I was, and I don't think that anyone mentioned what I am. And I guess it's customary that a chairman at least take a few moments to tell who he is, but I'm not going to. If I were to stick to the truth, it gets a little embarrassing, and it's none of your darn business. Number two, it would take too long. And number three, the descriptions are too varied and confusing, and they're not acceptable in mixed crowds like this anyway. I suppose that I should at least, as chairman, say so that you know I'm up here legitimately, I should say that I am Jim M. and I'm an alcoholic. But I ain't going to do that either. For 14 years, I have gotten up in front of crowds like this, not like this, believe me, and said, I am Jim M., and I don't know for sure whether I'm an alcoholic or not, and who gives a hoot. And I see no reason for changing tonight. But if it'll make anybody feel a little more comfortable, I'll start out this way first. I am Jim M., an alcoholic. Marge and I don't care. She wasn't interested in anything except my drinking. Actually, I had a triple problem. See, I have to do everybody a little, an alcoholic has to do everybody a little better. You've heard of the people with dual problems. I have a triple problem. Number one, I couldn't drink successfully. Number two, I couldn't stay sober successfully. Number three, I decided my life was a complete mess. That was my triple problem. Now, so far, with these qualifications, I have been accepted for the time I've been in as a bona fide member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Someday, Marge and I are going to look into the fact as to whether I qualify as an alcoholic or not. Now, evidently, for the newer people who might be here tonight, these three qualifications seem to be at least a perfectly acceptable substitute for a notarized witnessed affidavit proving that I am an honest-to-goodness, dyed-in-the-wool, pure alcoholic. That might give you a little bit of a clue of what I am. I'm known as a nonconformist. And one of my former Southern California friends mentioned that, Jim, you don't get along too well with the nonconformists. And this is probably true. And there's nothing that a nonconformist hates any more worse than a conformist than a nonconformist that refuses to conform to the principles of nonconformity. And that's hard to say with a new set of teeth, I can tell you. I know that somebody after this meeting is going to be accusing me of, as they usually do, of not taking my AA too seriously. In fact, they say I make a little too much light of it, a little facetious. To be honest with you, this is the only way I can get serious about AA. The one thing that AA has given back to me is a sense of humor. And if you had a past and a present like I've got, and you look in the mirror, take a good look at yourself as the program allows us to do, you better develop a sense of humor, I can tell you. Well, that's about enough of that. I received a letter from Herb here a couple months ago asking me to be the chairman of the meeting tonight. He mentioned that the theme of the convention was responsibility. And he said in the letter, he said, your particular responsibility is to open and close the meeting on time. And that was just about it. Well, that didn't concern me too much at the time. I thought I'll see him in Toronto. And so I did a couple days ago. And I says, Herb, I'd like to talk to you for a few moments. He says, this is fine. I says, just exactly what am I supposed to say in between the time I open the meeting and close it? Herb says, what did the letter say that you were supposed to say in between the opening and the closing? And I looked at him very indignantly, and I said, absolutely nothing. There was a long pause, and then I said, oh.
Least of all does our first speaker need an introduction. Her name, almost from the very beginning, has been synonymous with the problem of alcoholism and Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know how you introduce one of the first ladies who are in AA, but the subject is the first women in AA, and there is no better person to talk about that particular subject than one of the first women in AA. So, ladies and gentlemen, I would like to present to you Marty M. from New York.
I don't know whether I'm glad or sorry that everybody moved up front, up here. Because while they were back there, I was thinking of what a field day I was going to have, and nobody would know what I was saying, so they couldn't stop me. Now I have to be responsible and follow the theme of this meeting, and I'm very happy to do that. Let me say that one of the real thrills that I have had at this 30th anniversary meeting is the very great number of women members of AA that I've had the pleasure of meeting and seeing and hearing. There was a time when I wondered if that day would ever come. There was a time when the men members were sure it would never come. In fact, looking back on it now, I know exactly what they thought of me for many months. She's a freak. She's one of a kind, and there aren't any more like her. And I think they were very glad of that.
I was particularly pleased not only at being asked to appear here, which I consider a kind of crowning honor of my years in AA, but also to be given the task of talking about those first women members. But to do it properly, I have to go back a little bit and talk about my own coming into AA. And I think I could properly begin that when after 5 years of searching, I had finally found a kind of a home in a psychiatric hospital in Connecticut. And I had found a kind of a father in a man whom I was trying to make sit next to me down there. His name is Harry Thibault. He was the man who took me in. He was the one who apparently believed that there might be some hope for me. I had been sent to him by a very famous neurologist in New York who had told me flatly that people like me, in his experience, and he'd had many years of it, had one chance in 100 of getting well. He had not followed that up by specifying just what was wrong or why I had such a slim chance. But I didn't need that because I had long been convinced that I was hopelessly insane. And even though he told me that I wasn't, I didn't believe him. I just thought he was being kind. When he succeeded in getting me into Dr. Thibault's capable hands in the sanitarium he headed, and I began to get what I had so desperately been seeking, which was treatment for my insanity, I thought, a lot of things began to happen that were good, and I began to feel a very much better, and to feel that I was beginning to grasp some of the reasons for why this condition had overtaken me. You see, back in the 30s, we didn't talk about alcoholism. We didn't talk about drinking as being the problem. And, in fact, in my experience, there are not enough people who do it today. There are still too many who are looking for other reasons, and they're not all alcoholics, believe me, and who go on looking for those reasons while assuming that their alcoholic patients are just going to dry up naturally somehow. It just doesn't work that way. I experienced that in the sanitarium. You see, I was Dr. Thibault's patient, and he said right in the beginning that I was one of those people who couldn't drink. But he was only one of the psychiatrists up there, and there were other patients there, and their doctors were teaching them how to drink normally. So I thought there was something wrong with Dr. Thibault. And I felt very put upon that I had a doctor like that, whom I had quickly found out didn't much like to drink himself. I just thought he was a spoiled sport. I didn't know how fortunate I was. But to collapse this story, because this is not the evening where I tell my full story as an alcoholic, despite the fact that I was making some progress, despite the fact that Dr. Thibault never let up on his insistence that I couldn't drink, and that most of the time, of course, I didn't, every once in a while, I did, with somewhat disastrous consequences. And this happened enough times so that Dr. Thibault said to me, after one of these episodes, that perhaps it wasn't doing me any good after all, and perhaps he wasn't going to be able to help me, and if it happened again, perhaps I'd better leave. Well, frankly, this was my last hope. This was in 1938 and 9. And there wasn't any place else for me to go. If I had gone out of there, I think my only next move would have been death or commitment to a state mental institution from which I might never have emerged, at least not in those dark ages of lack of treatment for people like me in official mental hospitals. Furthermore, I think I would have so utterly and completely lost hope that it would have been curtains inside, which would have meant eventually curtains outside, too. Things were at this pass when one day Dr. Thibault was home sick with a cold, and he telephoned the sanitarium and said that he would like to see me in his home. He had something he wanted to show me and tell me about. This was a very unusual proceeding, and I went down in some trepidation, wondering what was up. And he waved at me a book in cardboard covers of what looked like a manuscript. And he said, "I have been reading this, and it's written by a group of people like you. I think maybe they have found something, and maybe what they have found will help you. I want you to read." And he put into my hand what was, in effect, the manuscript of a book whose title was Alcoholics Anonymous. I was very excited, and I took it back to the hospital and began to read with mounting excitement. I was never one of those that objected to the name alcoholic or the word alcoholism, because I'd been convinced I had things so much worse that were nameless, they were too awful to say, that to find that I had a name, I had something that had a name, was to me a very wonderful discovery. I embraced it happily, and I've always liked those two words ever since. And everything was going fine as I found I was learning quite a bit about what it was that I had, and that there were other people like me, lots of other people apparently, until I tripped and stumbled over a capital letter. The capital letter G. The other two letters were O-D. This I was not ready to accept. And so I went to Dr. Thibault and I said, this is not for me. This is just another form of emotional self-hypnosis. This is another opiate. This is not what you've been trying to teach me. This is an emotional way out. I don't believe in it, and I can't accept it. And he listened, very sympathetically, and when I'd finished, he said, well, go back and read some more. This went on for a number of weeks. I read as slowly as possible. I read only enough to give myself material with which I could argue with Dr. Thibault. He wasn't a very good arguer because he just listened, and when I finished, he said, go back and read some more. I don't know how long this might have gone on, but as so frequently happens with us, that most of us come to recognize that it's not accident, that there is something much deeper and greater involved, a crisis occurred in my life. It was a major crisis. It affected a member of my family. I felt responsible for it. I felt it wouldn't have happened if I hadn't been where I was and in the condition I was in. And yet there was not one single thing that I could do about it. It also made me violently angry, the greatest anger I have ever felt. And in the midst of this anger, sitting in my room, which was a tiny little room up on the third floor of a big old house, under the eaves with a little window, my eye fell on this darn book that I had to have there all the time because of Dr. Thibault, and it was open. I wasn't looking at it deliberately. I wasn't seeing anything very clearly. But there in the middle of the page, there were a few words that stood out as if they were in raised block letters, black and clear. And those words read, we cannot live with anger. It's very difficult to know why those particular words at that particular moment acted as a battering ram that knocked down any resistance that I might have left to the basic concept of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what it did. It knocked it down so completely that for quite some time I was totally unaware of where I was or what was going on. I must have been on my knees beside the bed for quite a while because the bedspread was wet with my tears. And when I raised my head, I had a sensation of freedom, of absolute and complete freedom, such as I had never known in my life. I was raised up, lifted up. I was beyond any bonds, any imprisonment, any holdbacks of which I had known and felt so many. And I looked out of that little window on the third floor, and I knew, beyond any doubt, that I could walk out that window and keep walking. And as I looked out that window, I saw a bluer sky than I had ever seen, and greener leaves and grass than I had ever seen, and the whole world looked newborn and fresh. And suddenly it dawned on me that I really did believe that I could walk out of a third-story window and keep on walking. And then it occurred to me that maybe this really was insanity. And I rushed downstairs. Dr. Thibault's office was on the ground floor, and I beat on his door. And although he had another patient, when he saw my face, he let me in. When I tried to tell him, I think I was gabbling a bit, and he asked me a number of very careful questions. When I had finished telling him what seemed to have happened, and that I now believed, because I knew, that God had been there in the room, that he was with me, Dr. Tebow said, "I do not think you are insane. I believe you've had an authentic spiritual experience. I believe it was of that kind because my resistance was so great. I know many people that have had spiritual experiences that have been gradual and easy. Mine was violent and really a little hard to take. But I have always been grateful and will always be grateful that I had such an experience." After that, I felt I had it made. I didn't need these people. He said one thing, which is go back and read the book. And I went back and started the book at the beginning, and somebody, while I was gone, had changed books on me. This was a completely new book. I sopped it up as a dry sponge sops up water. I read it through, and when I finished, I started and I read it again. And I read that book a number of times in the following weeks while I found reasons, excuses, rationalizations, and everything else to keep from going and meeting the people. You see, I'd always been scared of people. And I was particularly scared of these people because, well, one thing about that book was it was all about men. It was clearly a book written by men and for men. So I'd better do my own bit, you know. And besides, now I'd had this experience, I could do my own bit. Eventually, Dr. Tebow put an end to that nonsense and picked up the phone and said, "You're going into New York, and you're going to such and such an address where the husband is in AA, and he and his wife will take you to dinner, or give you dinner and take you to a meeting." Well, I sat with that man in one of the meetings this afternoon, and I was very happy that Popsy was here, who took me to my first meeting. When we arrived at this brownstone house in Brooklyn, I rushed upstairs to leave my coat, and I didn't come down. I was scared. I never saw so many people as were in that house. There must have been 30. It was an appalling mob. I'm awfully glad it's dark out there. I can't really tell how many of you there are. But it's always a little frightening to me to see a big crowd. And I can tell you that that little group of about 30 people in that brownstone house in Brooklyn looked just as big to me that night as you look to me tonight. Only I can't go upstairs and leave my coat and not come down. Not at this point, anyway. A very nice woman came up. She put her arm around me and she said, "You know, we want you down there." Her name was Lois. And she led me downstairs. And people began asking me questions immediately. Most of them were about, "When did you have your last drink?" And to my absolute horror, I told the truth. It never occurred to me not to, and then I was shocked that I had. And pretty soon I was in conversation, and it seemed to me that I was finishing their sentences and they were finishing mine, and, well, we were just talking the same language. The next morning, a man up in the sanitarium, to whom I had passed on the book after I'd found it so wonderful, but who refused to go to that first meeting with me, he said, "You go see what it's like, and then you tell me, and I'll go next time," telephoned into New York to see what it had been like. And I made just one comment. I said, "Granny, we're not alone anymore." And this, perhaps, was the greatest feeling I had. And yet, there wasn't a woman member there. I was it. Now, I'll grant you there are a lot of nice things about that. Particularly since a lot of the men didn't have wives. On the other hand, I really did feel that it would be very nice to talk to another woman alcoholic. I had met a couple in the sanitarium. In fact, I knew of one who was no longer there and who needed what we had. But she wasn't there at the moment, and I didn't quite know how to get to her. But I asked immediately, I said, "Aren't there any women in this group?" There was a story in this manuscript about a woman, but I hadn't met her. And I found that she was living in Washington, her name was Florence, where she and a man named Fitz had gone to try and start a group. and I looked forward very eagerly to her return to New York or her visit to New York so I could meet and talk with her. She was a considerably older woman, and she had a great many physical problems, too, and unfortunately, I only saw her sober on a couple of occasions. And she died before I had anywhere near completed my first year. So that did not really answer my need. And as the months went on, I worked awfully hard to get some companions in there. I don't know how many women I tried to help, but I didn't get anywhere with them. And I would go to the men who had had more time than I and ask for advice and help on this, and they began to give me a really peculiar look.
And it was perfectly clear to
Ray Fox, indeed,
that I was some kind of a freak.
And that no other women were ever going to respond to this. As a matter of fact, new men coming in looked at me as if I didn't belong there and said there was no such thing as a woman alcoholic. At least they didn't think there was. And I found that many people didn't think that women had this problem. That this was a man's problem, and AA was a man's program, and this was a man's world. And I didn't believe that. I had, over the years, known other women who had been in the same kind of trouble I was in, but they were mostly in England, that's where I got into my trouble, and where I knew a lot of others on my way down that were more or less like me. But I began looking very hard. The first one I went after was the one I had met in the sanitarium and who had gone home, and who, 6 months after I came into AA, and I attended my first meeting, incidentally, on April 11th, 1939. And I was not leaving the sanitarium, released from there, until mid-September. And the day before I left, an ambulance drove up, and someone was lifted out of that ambulance, and it was this other girl whose name was Nona. I was not able to see her, of course. She wasn't able to see anyone for a couple of days. She was in really bad case. But a week later, I received a telegram that she had escaped and that she was holed up in a hotel in New York, and would I go and see if I could find her, and I did. It was a pretty rough situation. We managed to get a nurse for part of the time, and I sat with her the rest of the time. And when she was finally physically sober, but in dreadful condition, I told her about AA, and I read the book out loud to her, and she said, "I want this. I want to meet these people." And there was a luncheon meeting that we held once a week in those days, and I took Nona to this luncheon. I remember somebody saying that they had watched the belt buckle on her dress, and it was jiggling like mad. Poor Nona was shaking all over. She had separated from her husband due to this problem, which they both had. And a couple of weeks later, they met to discuss the legal arrangements for a divorce, and he couldn't understand how she was sober. And she explained to him how and why she was sober, and he said, "Well, let's skip the divorce. I want this, too." So Walter also came into AA. Nona was my first successful case. Some months after that, we were meeting in those days at what we used to call A.E. Iolian Hall on West 57th Street. And we took a room for our meeting, and they locked the doors until we'd made the collection to pay for the room. We couldn't leave. And one night at this meeting, a young woman appeared with an older woman. And to my knowledgeable eyes, after my months in the institution, I knew perfectly well the older woman was a keeper. And sure enough, she was in another mental hospital up in Westchester, and she had been brought into this meeting. Well, everybody got me. I was the one woman, remember? And because Nona was not in New York at that time, she lived up in Connecticut and didn't get in for every meeting. I was there, and I never missed one. And they brought this girl over to me, and she looked pretty wild-eyed. Of course, later they told me I'd looked even more wild-eyed my first meeting, but I couldn't see myself, so I didn't know that. And I took a good look at her and at her keeper, and I told them, "I'm not going to spend any time on her. She hasn't a chance in a minute. She'll never make it. She didn't come here willingly anyway. She was dragged here against her will. Clearly, they sent her down. They had to have someone with her to see she didn't run away. Now, why should I waste my time on her? I've got plenty of cases I'm working on," which indeed I did, and none of them made it. But she did. Her name was Bobby. And Bobby Berger later became the secretary of what is today GSO, where she worked for many years and where her name became known to AAs all over the world because she was the one who corresponded with them. And this was the gal I said couldn't make it. Well, I was pretty glad she did make it. And it wasn't very long after that that one of her 12-step calls turned out well, and a gal named Isla came in. And Isla took to AA with both hands, and I mean both hands, because we just got our club on West 24th Street, and Isla did a good deal of the scrubbing down of walls and the scrubbing of floors and the making of curtains and the other things that went in to that first club that AA ever had. So now we were four. And really, Bobby and Isla and I were the three in New York. And very shortly thereafter, another girl came in that we liked very much, and then they began to come in some numbers. But this process consumed a good deal more than my first year in AA. And I can never forget those long, long early months when nobody believed that it was possible and nobody thought that another woman would ever make it. And naturally, this didn't make me feel very good, because if women couldn't make it, my making it was clearly a temporary thing. And when I unhappily had three slips in my first year and a half, I was pretty sure that I was a freak, but I wasn't going to be the only one. I wasn't going to make it. And I want you to know that from then to now, I have never ceased being grateful that I was one whom God granted the right to make it. And I feel that that's how it came about. I think it is terribly important in these days when so many more women are seeking help of AA and of information centers and of doctors and of clinics and in all kinds of ways where they think they might find help, to realize that this opportunity was not offered to us just a few years ago. 30 years may be a long time. But I knew an awful lot of women in the first few years that I was in AA who couldn't make it, who didn't make it, and I have always felt that in many cases it was because they were women. It was not because they were so much sicker. It was not because they didn't want to make it. But the odds were stacked so heavily against them that they never really had a chance. You see, I have always been convinced that the double standard that we have in both of our countries, Canada and the United States, and in many, many other countries too, about women, militates against women admitting this particular problem and seeking help about it, particularly if they fear that anyone might find out. Somehow it is acceptable on certain occasions and in certain places and for quite long periods for a man to get drunk. It is never under any circumstances acceptable for a woman to get drunk. We're all brought up knowing this. And when it begins to happen to us, and we are aware of what people think of a woman getting drunk, particularly in public, we go underground. We hide. We do our drinking in our bedroom. At least as much as we can, until we're too drunk to know the difference, and then we go wandering out and everybody does find out. And our shame is so great, and our sense of degradation weighs so heavily upon us, that we're paralyzed. We find it difficult to move in any direction. From my point of view, then, the full acceptance of alcoholism as a disease which can be treated, the full realization that Alcoholics Anonymous is just as much for women and works just as well for women as it does for men, is a tremendously important message. Today I know hundreds and thousands of women AAs all over the country. But let me tell you that there are many more hundreds of thousands who are still hiding in their bedrooms, who are still doing their drinking after they get home, who have still managed somehow, by hook or by crook, to more or less successfully conceal their condition. I have seen it on the walls, I read it in the memento book, and I want to commit it to memory, which I have not yet done. But I have it here, and I'm going to end with it, because I think it has double meaning for women and about women. I am responsible. When anyone, anywhere, reaches out for help, I want the hand of AA always to be there. And for that, I am responsible. I take that responsibility. I hope you will, too.
Thank you very much, Marty. I think that certainly showed what the people thought of what you had to say. Now, this next introduction is just going to be simple, pure pleasure for me personally. I honestly feel a certain prerogative in having this opportunity because so many of the members of the board have accused me of being a ringer from Al-Anon anyway. And for just this particular moment, I would like to plead guilty. Our speakers with us tonight, not only is our co-founder's mate, it would seem to me that she represents much more than that. In coming to the microphone, she is also a symbol of a long overdue recognition of alcoholism as a family problem, and also of the emergence of Al-Anon as a fellowship in its own right. Strangely enough, she was a member of Al-Anon long, long before there was ever a fellowship by that name. That takes quite a woman to do that. So, my friends, it makes me feel very grateful to present the First Lady of both fellowships, AA and Al-Anon, our beloved Lois.
Everybody. Hi. This is one of the most thrilling meetings I've ever been at. I don't know whether I'll be able to even say a few words because it's so very moving to see so many of you. Okay, thanks. In the beginning of AA, it was a family affair. Parents, mates, and children accompanied the AAs to meetings, which often were held in homes. Anyone lucky enough to still have a home shared it with those without one, who were most of the people. Our house buzzed like a beehive. Such terrific excitement and enthusiasm existed about this wonderful program, but no one considered carrying on any outside activities. When not 12-stepping or attending meetings, AA was the enthralling topic of conversation morning, night, and noon. Any new prospect was treated like the find of a raw diamond, and all were anxious to help polish him and to see that he got the program. It wasn't too long, however, before some AAs felt that they needed meetings for alcoholics only. When the families were thus left to themselves, they sometimes met together too. And eventually, Al-Anon grew out of this. The mutuality of the old days seemed wonderful. But we mates now have something much deeper and more useful. Then we thrilled with gratitude over the dramatic recovery of our dear ones. But we never thought about changing ourselves. Consequently, when the pink cloud faded, we woke up to find our alcoholics way ahead, often leaving behind in us hurt feelings, resentment, and self-pity. Now, with Al-Anon coming into maturity and its members practicing the AA principles in all their affairs, Home lives can be based solidly on real understanding and true partnership. We thank you, dear AAs, for showing us the way. Thank you all.
Thank you, Lois. I think I can speak in... I'm a little taller than she is. And I think I can speak in behalf of all the Al-Anon members and the... I think probably for the mates of some of the Al-Anon members, too, and saying we're real happy that you stuck around. Comes my easiest and probably the most simple introduction. It's useless to think of an introduction for this man. You and I were all introduced to him when we attended our first AA meeting. It is impossible to find an introduction that has not already been used. Every known adjective, every type of descriptive phrase has been spoken in this man's behalf, all of them inadequate to express our gratitude. This makes it very easy for me because there are no introductions left. So I'll just simply say that each of you are sitting out there and we're all sitting up here with our respective lengths of sobriety only and only because this man is able to come to the podium and say that I have been sober around about 30 years. Mine is one of the great privileges of our fellowship to give you our co-founder and the man responsible for all of this, just plain Bill.
Sure that each of us seated here of AA and Al-Anon will declare that this hour may be the brightest yet that we have ever known in our entire lives. I bring from AA worldwide greetings to this nation, to this city, and to all of our sisters and brother in AA here. We are grateful to you. Above all, we are grateful to God, who through us has wrought this wholesale miracle of liberation. This is a time, too, for happy reminiscence. People say, how did it all begin? And this is the 30th anniversary of that beginning. But this is not really so. In my view, this is our 33rd anniversary. AA really began in Switzerland. It took shape in some of its main essentials in a conversation between the beloved Dr. Jung, one of the founders of modern psychiatry, and the only one, so far as I know, who had the temerity to believe that man consisted of more than $2 worth of chemicals, a bundle of instincts, and something perhaps mistakenly called a brain. Dr. Jung thought there was more to humans than this. And with him, we nowadays certainly agree. Now let's get to the point, and let me reproduce that scene in his office that took place, I should think, in 1932. A certain American businessman, once of large importance, had gone the route that all of us had drawn. He was beset by a compulsion that condemned him to drink against his will and interest. He wanted to stop. As we say, he was hooked. He could not. He had run the gamut of the cure, so-called, in this country. And so he approached Carl Jung. He stayed there in Switzerland a year. He and Jung became great friends. And as time passed, his inner motivations were revealed to him. He thought to himself, and so told his doctor, "Now I think I understand. I hope and believe that I am free." He left the doctor. In less than 60 days, he was back again, hopelessly in the toils. And he said, "Doctor, I really wish to know the score." Said this great and humble man, "Roland, when you first came, and for a time after, I thought that my art might help you. I thought you might be one of the very few that we could help. But no, in your case, it is not so. My art cannot save you." Well, coming from a founder, I say these were humble words. And this is how AA started, in the humility, the wisdom, the humanity of that great man. "So," said the patient, "but doctor, you are my court of last resort. Is there no other resource? Nothing that can be done?" And Dr. Carl replied, "Yes, Roland, something else can be tried, but there is no warranty that it can be done." Time out of mind, men have had so-called spiritual experiences. Some say religious conversions. The essence of these experiences being a shift in motivation, a restoration to sanity where there had been insanity, and an ability to do what the human being couldn't ordinarily have done on his own resources. And all of this seemingly as a sort of gift, not accountable by any discipline, any particular belief, or even any association. Said the patient, "But I am a man of faith." Jung said, "Fine, Roland, that's good. That's a step. But I am talking about the transforming experience. So put yourself in whatever spiritual atmosphere you choose and hope that the benign lightning is going to strike you. It is your only chance. Such in substance was what Carl Jung said to an alcoholic in the year 1932. And that, I think, was where we began, too. Roland came to America. He joined the Oxford groups of that day. These good people were emphasizing simple religious common denominators. They, too, were saying men and women cannot manage their own lives. So let us admit this. They were saying, let's be honest with ourselves. Let's quit living alone. Let's talk it out with another person. Let us make restitution for harms done. And let every man address the God of his choice for help in carrying out these ideas. This was the substance of their teaching. It was not new. It was a particular emphasis. And among these people, Roland found a few alcoholics who had sobered, and to his intense joy and surprise, his desire for drinking left him. And he bethought himself of a friend of mine, one in our history called Ebby. And he'd gone the same way. He was about to be committed for alcoholic insanity. Roland and another friend rescued him from the judge. Roland took him to his own home, then brought him to the groups in New York. Meanwhile, I had started life with great happiness and high prospects. From the first day I drank as an officer in the World War, I was drunk. After the 1929 collapse, and my money was lost, still, hope was not gone, but the drinking increased. It finally reached such a terrible severity that nobody would have a thing to do with me. The process of isolation closed in. Lois was the only one standing by. Meanwhile, I desperately wanted to drink. I didn't know how. I didn't know what the matter was with me, really. You know, standing here in Toronto tonight, it reminds me that I have come full circle. For it so happened that my last business opportunity was had here and lost here. I had a friend in New York who thought of coming to Toronto to open up in the mines. He asked me to come when no other friend would have done this. He never reproved me for my drinking. He stood for a lot. Somehow, why I'll never know, he had confidence in me, yet. And I came up here. And we lived in the Royal George. And I tried hard. But as you know, I drank harder. And finally I said to him, look, Joe, I am no good to you. I'm washed up. I'm through. This thing has got me. I'm standing in your way. I'm going home. And then I got so drunk that I ignominiously had to be taken down in the freight elevator of our hotel. Returning home, one hospitalization after another, finally came that summer night when my doctor, Dr. Silkworth of Towns Hospital, New York, was talking with Lois down in his office. And he said, in effect, Lois, I'm afraid at last I have to tell you the truth. Bill senses it. He knows it in his heart. I must give it to you as a fact. He has a compulsion to drink that no resource of mine can break, nor of his.
He has a physical sensitivity to alcohol, so that if his drinking continues, it means madness, even death. Sitting in this audience tonight, I make no doubt there are several thousand women on whom this sentence has been pronounced, directly or by implication, and certainly all of us have come to just about the same impasse. We have hit bottom. And Lois said, what can be done? And the doctor said, I think you'll have to lock him up. Or he may be brain damaged within a year. Of course, I'm not so sure that I wasn't brain damaged right then. Ever since, too. Anyhow, I left the hospital. I was scared to death. Constant vigilance kept me from drinking for a while. I got confident, went back to the street, made a few dollars. But again, the old rationalizations. Again, it was a bottle. Again, I was in the toils. Again, I knew what the doctor said was true. I was a goner, this time for good. At this very moment in AA history, before I was dry, and long before we had this name, my friend Ebby came to me. I was sitting in the kitchen of our house at Clinton Street in Brooklyn, with a bottle of gin on the table, Lois working in the department store. The telephone rang. My friend Ebby was on the other end. Somehow I sensed he was sober. Something that had never happened to him in New York City. I said, come right over. We'll talk about the good old days. Oh, what a significant expression that. If we talked and drank and remembered the good old days, we could forget the present and the obvious future. So that's what we do. Soon he was at the areaway door. I went out, and I sensed that there was something new about him. He was not only sober, but it was a subtle something or other. And I said to myself, what's happened? He placed himself at the kitchen table, and through the gin haze, I surveyed him from the other side. And I said, Ebby, what's got into you? What's happened? You don't want to drink. You say you're not drinking now. What do you mean by this? Well, he said, I'll put it to you straight. I got religious. Well, for one scientifically trained, this was like swatting me in the puss with a wet mop, you know. But one had to be polite. So I said to Abby, tell me, what brand is this that you have? He said, I wouldn't call it a brand. And then he enumerated these little cliche common denominators, so they seemed to me, you know, about getting honest yourself and making restitution and all the rest of it. And as he talked, it grew on me that here was a fellow who had something more than water wagon sobriety. As he said, he was released. And this was how it had been done. But then my treasured scientific training piled in on me and said, no, no. I cannot get well on what I know to be a delusion. So I felt very much trapped. Abby finally went away. And in the days that followed, I went on drinking. But never in any waking hour would his face and what he had to say disappear. And finally, I thought to myself, I must look again. This time with clear eyes, I'll go to the hospital. I'll have Dr. Silkworth straighten me out again.
As a real conservative Yankee, if there is to be any conversion, it mustn't be sensational. So I went to the hospital, and like most of us on the way to be cured for the last time, I was stewed. I came in waving a bottle of gin. Dr. Silkworth looked at me sadly. I shouted, "Doc, this time I've got something." And he said, "Well, my boy, I guess you have. You better get upstairs and get to bed." So I did, and I'd come early on to the hospital, so I wasn't in too bad shape. And two or three days later, there was no more medication. But I felt horribly depressed. And I kept wondering about what my friend had said. Well, you see, here one alcoholic was talking to another at depth, across the kinship of a common suffering. He spoke the language of the heart that gripped one somewhere deep inside. He had started to bind me with cords of love from which I was never to escape. And suddenly he stood in the door. And then I was afraid of being evangelized. I said, "Here's where he turns on the heat and the light." But he didn't. He just paid me a nice cordial visit. And he actually forced me to ask him, "What's that nifty little formula you got, Abby, that booze cure of yours? Will you tell me again?" And again he ripped through the principles. Again he mentioned God, and I winced. And again he went away and said he'd be back in a day or two. And after he had gone, I said, "What a dilemma. You are within reach of recovery, and for lack of faith you cannot get hold of it. I sank into a terrible depression. And finally, like a child crying in the dark, I said, "If there is a God, will he show himself?" No faith, just an appeal to something or somebody, or maybe to nobody. And instantly, the room lit up in a great white light. I was seized in an ecstasy that was indescribable. I felt I was on a mountaintop. A great wind was blowing. I thought, "This is not air, this is spirit." It went around and through me. And all of a sudden I cried, "I am a free man." And as the experience subsided, I found myself, of course, still on my bed, but yet I seemed to be in a different world of consciousness, a world that was all right no matter how wrong it was. And then I was suffused by a sense of presence, and I thought to myself, "So this is the peace that passes all understanding. This must be the God of the preachers." Now I make haste to say, of course, that this was a dramatic experience. But in its essentials, it was in no wise different than that which each AA member, whether he knows it or not, is actually getting as recovery comes to him. Let me illustrate. Soon after this occurrence, the great turning point in my own life, my friend Abby returned and handed me a book, then much read in the Oxford groups. It was written by a man today called the father of modern psychology, William James of Harvard, who had long since passed away, had done this book, and it was an examination of these transforming experiences.
And the book not only portrayed their variety, but it also revealed their essentials. And nearly all of these experiences had come to people who in some controlling area of their lives had been absolutely stuck against the wall over which none could go, nor around, nor under. They were founded on a basis of human calamity. Then the human, or the remains of him, reached out toward a higher power, and then suddenly, or perhaps very gradually, the shift, the transformation, the remotivation began. So, having heard from my own doctor that I was hopeless, he was my god of science. An even greater god was Dr. Jung. Inferentially, he had said the same thing. This I knew in my heart. So I met the conditions of the cases in the book. And then, like them, I had reached them. And my experience was sudden and brilliant. But something had happened. I was actually scared at the time. I called in the doctor. And luckily he, too, was not so much a great physician as he was a great human being. And he listened. And I said, "Doc, am I crazy? Am I bugs? Am I hallucinating?" And he shook his head and said, "No, Bill." He said, "You are not crazy. I have read of these occurrences in the books, but I have never seen one. In way I cannot describe, you are different than you were a little while ago. Some great psychic event has occurred. And whatever it is, my friend, you'd better hang on to it. It's ever so much better than what had you even an hour ago." And in the wake of this, almost naturally, there came a vision. How if we used the scientific knowledge of the difficulty, the impossibility of this condition, and one alcoholic projected that to the next over this common identification so easily made, then deflation at depths could come to other people. And they too might reach out to a higher power, if only to their group, to people who are sober in contrast with their drunkenness. So these were some of the original concepts that were not in the least the invention of Dr. Bob and me. They were all drawn from our friends of medicine and religion. We had just begun to fashion a missing link in the chain of recovery. Well, I began working with tremendous enthusiasm with drunks. There were lots of them down at the mission of Calvary Church, where Sam Shoemaker, then head of the Oxford Groups in America, presided. The doctor let me work on some at Towns Hospital. And then insidiously, the pride business came back. Yeah, I was heard to say that I was going to fix all the drunks in the world. I was. I was heard to say that anybody can have one of those experiences like mine, whereupon all the drunks tapped their head and said, "To hell with this business." He was nutty enough before. So I got no place because I was pontificating and because I was preaching. So there was a final link still to be forged in the chain of recovery. And this was first my own deflation to my right size. It came about in this way. Some of my friends says, "Why don't you give up the missionary job and get to work and support Lois and get her out of that store?" And I thought this was a good idea, so I scraped up a
some new acquaintances in Wall Street. Presently, I'm out in Akron, Ohio, on a proxy fracas, hoping to gain control through these new friends of a little machine tool company. Well, we got out there, very confident. 40% of the proxies were in our pockets. It was a pushover. I said, well, we'll get the bankroll fixed up, and you know I'll help a drunk now and then. But we got licked in the proxy fight, and my rather fair-weather friends departed for New York, and they neglected to leave me any money to get home myself. So I'm in the Mayflower Hotel with $10 in my pocket. I went down in the lobby. I walked toward the bar. I looked in. It was a Saturday afternoon. I thought to myself, well, I might go in and have a glass of ginger ale, or perchance make an acquaintance. And suddenly I caught myself and said, ah, here comes the old rationalizations. What shall I do? Maybe I'm going to get drunk. And then at long last, I remembered how my efforts, however poor they were, to help others, had also helped me to maintain my stability and my sobriety. So I thought, if I will save myself, I must find another alcoholic in this town, and right now. Walking to the other end of the church lobby, I saw a list of clergymen and their churches. And running my finger at random down this list, I came to the name of a preacher. A rather odd name it was, Walter Tunks. He had the Episcopal parish there. I called up the Reverend Tunks, and I said, I am an alcoholic from New York. I am temporarily sober with the help of some Oxford Group friends, but none of these are around, and I'm afraid I'm going to get tight, so I've got to have another drunk to work on. Well, at first, the prospect of one drunk at a time was enough for Tunks. He couldn't see bringing two together. But after a bit, he caught my meaning, and he said, I'll tell you what you do. You call up Norman Shepherd, chief chemist over at the Firestone. He's one of the group, but Oxford Group's not a drinker. But he'll give you some names. I know he will. I'll tell him, too. And from Norman, I got a list of names. And I began calling them one by one. Well, this was a strange request, another drunk to work on, so they can be pardoned for seeing me in church Sunday, perhaps, or some other day, or they were busy, or they would be out of town. And one by one, my list evaporated. Until at the very end, there stood a name, Henrietta Seiberlin. And I thought of the old Wall Street days when I had met Frank Seiberlin, the founder of the Goodyear Company. I knew he and his wife would be on it years. I couldn't imagine calling her up looking for a drunk to work on, could I? So I go down and I look at the directory some more. And something said to me, you had better get upstairs and call that number. Oh, on what small seeming events our destinies can turn. A southern voice came on the wire. I explained to her. She caught my drift at once. She said, I'm no drinker, but I've had my troubles. You come right out here now. So I arrived at the estate, and at the door of the gatehouse stood Henrietta. I explained. She said, I have just a man for you. We've had a doctor that can't get sober in the group here. We know he wants to. The family has gone to pot. The house is about to be foreclosed. A prominent surgeon, he's lost his place at the city hospital. He wants to stop, but he can't. Would you like me to call up his wife, Ann? Oh, I said, please do.
So Henrietta called Ann and said, Ann, there is a man here from New York who has been able to stop drinking, and he'd like to talk with Dr. Bob, if he might. He says it would help him, and maybe he could help Dr. Bob. Well, Ann said, you know, it's Mother's Day, and Dr. Bob is really a kind man, and he's brought me a beautiful plant. And the plant is sitting here on the table, but he is lying under the table, quite unable to get up. So I don't think that we will be here today. Next day, though, they came at 5 o'clock, and Dr. Bob and Ann stood in the door. And Dr. Bob didn't look like the founder. He was shaking. He was in a hurry. He said, I can only stay a few minutes. I said, I know you're thirsty. Diplomatically, Henrietta put us into the library. We talked for hours. This time, I'm no missionary. This time, I say, I need you even more, perhaps, than you need me. I need you to save myself. Instead of talking about this strange-sounding spiritual experience, I put it to him from the mouths of my doctor friends how hopeless this really was and why. He hadn't understood this. His relief was immense. He and Ann invited me to their house. I carried on the proxy fight. But Dr. Bob said, shouldn't we be working with alcoholics, you and me? And I said, yes. He called up the city hospital. There was a nurse he knew. He said, there's a man from New York who thinks he's got a cure for alcoholism. And the nurse rather dryly retorted, well, Dr. Bob, I hope you have tried it on yourself. She said, well, anyhow, we've got a dandy customer for you. He's just been brought in. He's a well-known attorney here in town. He's been here 4 times in 6 months. And he can't even get home sober from here. He has the DTs. He's blacked the eyes of one of the nurses. We've got him strapped down. Dr. Bob, how would you like that customer? He said, just the thing. We'll be down tomorrow. And on tomorrow, Dr. Bob and I saw for the first time what we of AA call the man on bed. So each of us told our stories. Each of us told him what this alcoholism thing was. But the man on the bed shook his head sadly. Boys, he says, this is great. You know what you're talking about. But me, I'm too far gone. He said, I can't even go home from here without getting stewed. But he said, you're the first persons in all my life that look to me like you know the score. Won't you come down tomorrow? So on the morrow we came. His wife was standing near the foot of his bed. Bill, his name was Bill too, looked at Doc and me. He said to her, these are the folks that understand. During the night, I thought to myself, if they can do this, I can do it. Wife, please fetch me my clothes. We're going to get up and we're going to get out of here. And the man on the bed stepped out of it and walked out into the world. And he went into a political campaign, and his opponents derided his drinking. He never had a drink until he died a few years ago. Neither did Dr. Bob. Neither have I. So that was the beginning of the first group of AA. As you know, another started in New York, another in Cleveland. Publicity came. The Cleveland groups proved that 20 members could take on 600 or 700, and as the result of a great burst of publicity, they made mass production of society possible. We got together and wrote a book called Alcoholics Anonymous. And the last chapter of the text is called, you will remember, A Vision for You. And in that text, written at a time when we had less than 40 recoveries, or less than 100 recoveries, I was looking the other day and found these words. They were words of hope, but to us at the time, scarcely prophetic. And here they are. Said we of AA, 1939, our hope is that when this chip of a book is launched on the world tide of alcoholism, defeated drinkers will seize upon it to follow its suggestions. Many, we are sure, will rise to their feet and march on. May we give thanks to a bountiful God for all that He has wrought among us ever since. Good night.